So then I worked for Brooks Brothers since 1997. After a year and a half at the Mall of America, I realized, you know, I'd come from this beautiful bucolic farm life into the Mall of America. I didn't like malls in the first place, but I had accepted this job, and I saw there was a listing of where all these other Brooks Brothers were, and I thought, okay, I could go work somewhere else. This might be my way out. So it was really a blessing that I didn't get any of those other jobs that I wanted so badly. And God was definitely leading me in the right direction. I just had to trust. And my friend in Cambridge was still encouraging me at this time. What happened was a friend of my parents came into the store at Brooks Brothers, saw I was there, and said, "But what happened? You know, what's going on?" And I began to tell the story, and I thought, I don't want to keep telling the story. I'm telling it now, but I don't want to keep telling the story at work to everybody that comes, you know, and sort of go through the melancholy of the loss. And I thought, no, I don't want my life to be about this. I do not want to go through life as a victim. So it was the first step for me. And I talked to my friend in Cambridge, and he said, "Well, you know, this couple that you know wants you to come and visit them in Delray Beach. Why don't you go there for good, for keeps?" And, "Oh God, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know. But I did. I transferred to store 28, which was on Worth Avenue in Palm Beach. I didn't know anybody but this couple. They said you could stay. I could stay there for 10 days, and then I had to find a place of my own. So that's what I did. I got a one-way ticket in the Mall of America. I sold everything. I sold all my books again. I couldn't take them with me. I sold all my winter clothes. I packed two suitcases, one steamer trunk, and a couple other things, and I shipped everything. And I prayed like hell this was going to work out. So then I've been in Florida ever since. I kept sending the book out, but nothing happened. But I kept sending it out. I kept working on it. So, the present, close to the present. I was working at Brooks Brothers. My friend who I dedicated the book to was starting to get very ill in Cambridge. He was also very poor. He was evicted from his apartment. And he was put into a nursing home, but he was still encouraging me. So what happened was I had sent it out to the 10 places, and by this time, you know, I'd done this so many times, I forgot where I sent it. I was already writing another book and sending out this book. It was January. I was closing the store 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, folding down all the cashmere sweaters, making them look perfect with the two pieces of tissue and the folding board and doing all that. And I was really kind of blue, I thought. I guess this is it. You know, I had this dream to write this book, and it's not going to happen. And I got to just accept it and move on. And it's okay that I thought this, and it's okay my friend encouraged me, but it's, you know, I got to be realistic. You know, maybe this is my life, to work here at Brooks Brothers, to advance through management. And this is must be God's plan. I just need to accept it. So I came home right around when I was thinking this. I came home and there was a message on the machine, and it was Michael Collier from the, he said, "I'm calling from the Bakeless Prize and I need to speak to you." I thought, I'm the runner up. He's calling to tell me that I'm the runner up. I was so sure of that. So he called me and he said, "You're not the runner up. You won." I said, "Are you sure? Sure it's not Spencer Lease or Spencer? Are you sure?" "Yep, I'm sure. Louise just is accepting it with reservations because it needs a little work. Are you willing to do that?" I said, "Well, sure." It was a shock. I didn't tell the management at Brooks Brothers for 6 months. I didn't tell anybody. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. But then Louise started calling my little apartment every day because we had to do these rewrites. So it was this weird time of, I mean, I was on the phone a lot, and then I would dash off to work and, you know, just get there in time for the 1 o'clock shift. That was very instrumental to have a voice like that who believed in the poems and could see what needed to be worked on, what needed to go, because I had looked at it for so long. Well, the other funny thing was when Michael Collier said it won, I said, well, what's the name of it? Because I couldn't remember if I'd said this or the new thing, which is now just a pile of rubble. But so fortunately, you know, it was this, so that was good. So Louise and I worked on the rewrites. And I contacted the nurses in the nursing home and told Durrell, you know, this news. I wrote him a letter. They would read him the letter because he wasn't coming to the phone anymore. So he knew about it. Then, before we had done the rewrites, and I said to Louise, well, you know, maybe we could try, or we said together or something, maybe we could try to get a few of these published somewhere because hardly anything was published anywhere. So I said, what about the New Yorker? Or she said, we'll try the New Yorker. I said, well, I've sent there for a million years. I just get a, you know, rejection letter. It's a form rejection letter. And she said, you need a password. And I know what the password is. I said, okay. So we sent them off, and I guess she, you know, let Alice Quinn know that they were coming or whatever the password was. But that, nothing happened for the longest time. So I thought, nothing's going to happen. And then I was fixing a pair of pants for a man and his wife. The wife was very upset. Look at his pants. They're not right. They're not bright. I've got pins in my mouth. We're pinning up the seat of his pants. It's too tight. It's too tight. The phone rings. It's for me. It's Alice Quinn. And she has a surreal voice. Anyway, she sounds like Laurie Anderson. Hello, Spencer. This is Alice Quinn from the New Yorker. You know, like that. Anyway, so anyway, I couldn't stay on the phone long because I had this pair of pants, and the woman was getting more and more upset. So she said, "Well, anyway, we decided to accept your poem," and I was in a state of shock. I finished the pants. I went to call Louise on the phone. I said, Louise, it's Alice on the phone. They've accepted that poem. And Louise said, you sound like somebody just died. But I was in a state of shock. The poem ran, and this is the weirdest, eeriest, I can't even explain it. The poem ran that morning. Durrell died that afternoon, the day the poem ran. He knew the poem was coming, and so it was the weirdest day of my life. People were calling my house. His sister called me and said, Durrell's passed away. So I was crying. I'm taking these phone calls from people that are so happy, were happy about seeing the poem. And it was a weird confluence of events that he was, you know, finally ready to leave me right at this moment. It was a lot to take in. Then several months down the line, when I debuted the book in New York, I called his sister and I said, I'm reading in New York at the Poet's House on March 29th. I hope you can come. And she paused on the phone and she said, but it's his birthday. And I thought, oh my God. So I read the book on his birthday, which seemed really fitting in New York. So that's it. I mean, the first reading I had was at the Library of Congress. I got on a plane with my friend Jenny, who you met. I said, come on, Jenny. I didn't have a partner in my life at that time. I said, come on, I'm not going to experience this alone. I've lived alone for 20 years. I said, I'm not going to do this alone. You're going to come with me. So I bought her ticket, and we went up to Washington, D.C., and we had a blast. That was the first reading. I wept and wept and wept. It was very emotional, as you can imagine, after all these years and just thinking this, you know, really almost giving up at the end, and then having it come true in this wild way. It was pretty overwhelming, but pretty one, it's been, you know, pretty amazing. So that's the story. That's enough words. That's it.
So Spencer, are you still at Brooks Brothers?
Yeah, I'm still there.
Full time?
Yeah, I'm full time.
How are you juggling?
That's a good question. It's been really challenging because retail is an exhausting business. I don't know if you can mention it, but it's very people intensive. I don't know another business like it. It's got everything in it. It's psychology, it's politics, it's merchandise, it's the exchange of goods, it's the oldest business in the world. It's, you know, it's got all that in it, but it's consumerism and it's consuming. I mean, it definitely sucks you in. I had no intention of being in it, but it's provided me with a life. I've experienced great bounty since this has occurred, and I won the Guggenheim, which was another shockero. And so I'm going to step down to 4 days a week because I think I'm going to blow my circuit soon if I don't. It's been, the last 2 years have been stressful, no question about it. We opened a new store. We're the largest store in Florida. It's a $4 million store. I'm the assistant manager, and I'm responsible for a lot of stuff at this point. All the visual merchandising, being sure I know what the numbers are if the district manager calls, each person's touch base, how much they're making, are they making their threshold, and it's a lot to keep in your head. So, with some trepidation, because I'm sort of used to it now, I'm going to step down and be there 4 days a week, keep, you know.
So how do you manage your time? I mean, how do you got a specific time that you write and a specific time that you kind of revise, or, you know, because then you have to be at work. I'm just curious that personal side of how you manage to compartmentalize.
It's
striking as being so passionate that I'm sure you have a lot of passion about your work at Brooks Brothers as well.
I do. I suffer from perfectionism. I was just talking about that with a close friend of mine this past week, and how I need to let go of that. I don't need to be perfect at work. I don't need to say everything perfectly, do everything perfectly. I don't need to be applauded for every job that I do. But, you know, that's my journey with a lot of adult children of alcoholics. I have learned, you know, suffer from some of these things. And at this point, I want to let go of some of them because they're not serving me. I write whenever I can. In the last 2 or 3 years, I have written a lot, and a lot of it's been very bad and sort of versions of what's in there. It's not new yet, I guess. But I did write one little one that I think is okay. And I've worked on that for a long, long time. So I go over it, and I'm not trying to read a lot now. Actually, mostly fiction. If I read poetry, it drives me crazy. So I think I should be doing this. So I just keep reading fiction and nonfiction, and I love biography. So I'm just reading a lot. And I did write one little thing, though, and I have a notebook of stuff, and I try to keep a diary. So it just happens when it can happen. There's no set time, really, although I think I'm more of a morning person as I age. When I was younger, I was a night person, my 20s and my 30s, but by your 40s or my 40s, I'm much more of a morning. It's gonna happen in the morning.
Do you have a writer's group?
No, I don't. There is not a lot of writers, poets in Florida. There are some. I met Campbell McGrath, who teaches in Miami, but that's almost 3 hours from me. I liked him. I thought, oh, this would be a good friend to have, but, you know, it's hard to have a friend that distance, he's got a young family, and so I don't really. Most of the people that I show my stuff to are not poets. Well, except Louise. I show Louise Glick my things. Actually, I showed her this one poem that she thought was okay. Some of the others, I have sent her what I and met with her since the book. She said, I'm interested in, you know, seeing what you're doing. So it was helpful to know it wasn't that good. So I'm sort of struggling with that. All over again. I'm starting all over again, and it's kind of daunting. So I guess, yeah, I'm just trying to live life now and have more life before there's more to write about, I guess. But I have ideas of things I do, definitely. I've been trying to write, but they just aren't that good. So I've been doing research. I've been doing all kinds of stuff, but I had this idea that I want to write about the city of Hartford, so I read all these books about Hartford. My mother grew up in Hartford, but it's not coming together. There was a horrible circus fire there. I read all about that, and I remember my mother telling me about it in 1944. They used to dip all the tents and paraffin to make them waterproof, and they caught fire in Hartford, and it was this big disaster. But besides being really interested in it, I've sort of tried to write about it, but it just isn't working. We were talking on the phone about writing from self-experience as opposed to writing like a more detached, is that where, you know, like a...
Yeah.
So that kind of concerns me or interests me. I tried to write a really detached book and I couldn't do it. And at the same time, I read at the Library of Congress with a woman named Dana Levin. Have you read her book called In the Surgical Theater? It's a great, incredible book. But that was the kind of book I wanted to write. It was a sort of this detached, vatic, omniscient, personal, impersonal voice, and I thought, oh, that's what I wanted to do, but I guess I didn't, so.
Spencer, it always seems to me that a lot of the writers you've spoken of as inspirations, like Merrill or Bishop,
right,
and you know, even the metaphysical poets, maybe it's a kind of capacity to write a poem that's very personal sometimes.
Yeah.
And other poems which are observational but just filled with so much of the self and the woundedness of the self, even when that's not referred to specifically. Bishop's a great example of those poems are about,
yeah,
you know, her family madness and her orphanhood, her outsiderhood in a lot of ways.
Right.
So maybe we think of it as too strict a dichotomy sometimes.
I think I do. I don't know why that is. Maybe that's, it's not all black and white, or it doesn't just have to be one thing, or Sylvia Plath doesn't have to be all bad just because she was a confessional poet. I mean, I think she's still a great poet. Those words live, they work. So a lot of people of her generation, they don't.
I really admire the non-confrontational way your poems are confessional. You know, it just eases itself in there. You are clearly emoting in the background. You're clearly feeling everything that's said and are attached to it. Even distance observations, things that seem distant. For me, every line has you behind it, feeling every line, and that's something that's really hard for me to do. I tend to somewhere in the middle of a poem like that, I'll get lost either in my own head or, you know, trying to make the observation interesting or dramatic or whatever you're trying to get at, and I lose that ease. Greg actually last night, Greg Donovan, described it to me. He's like, it's like it's like he's launching a boat, a very small boat in calm waters. He's just kind of pushing it out, and you get in the boat, and you don't even know that you're there, and you kind of, it just eases out. It's beautiful. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I envy it.
Well, thank you.